Y'all ready to roll this thing? Get it rolling? Yeah. Mr. Robert Gordon,
Mr. Glenn Conway.
Thank you, JB. Thank you, WYXR. Greg put this thing together. I'm the co-pilot, but I'm saying something first. I broke the chair. We're breaking chairs now. It's going to get rocking.
It's so punk,
exactly. Welcoming the Hellcats over here, sitting in the chairs. Honor, and they'll be up here.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. A lot of people came from out of town. Lisa, Missy, Diane, thank you so much for making the trip.
Christy came from San Francisco. Oh, she's kind of.
And roughly the way the night works is we'll have a little chat here first. Greg and I will give a little context. There'll be a short talk with the Hellcats. You'll go into one room or the other, listen to side A, come back, have another little chat, go into the other room, listen to side B, come back here and have another little chat, then go about your merry way. We appreciate you being here. So the first EP comes out in 1987, I just checked, because I brought my records to get them. Since all the Hellcats are here, I was like, hell yeah, I'm gonna get them signed.
Well, the first EP was recorded in December 87 and came out in the spring of 88.
Okay, so we've got like the late 80s represented, and roughly what for the LP? 2 years later, 1 year later?
The LP was recorded around January 90 and came out a few months later.
Okay, so 1988 and 1990.
Yeah.
Don't mess up my
record covers. Gotcha.
Because I got them signed. And so this is, pretty strongly punk, post-punk years, it's do-it-yourself years, let's call it that, the DIY era, and Memphis was happening because, for all the reasons that Memphis has ever happened, and none of them, and then especially because Alex Chilton had made a deal in France with a record label called New Rose, and that guy, Patrick Mate, was really interested in the Memphis scene and became a conduit for a lot of bands from here to get out of here, which is kind of the hardest thing to do. And so Tab Falco followed, and in short order, the Hellcats followed. So that's the 1987 EP, and then they're working at Easley Recording and Easley McCain Recording. Initially in Doug's backyard, was the LP at the big studio?
No, the whole thing, we all...
Both of them in the backyard?
We think we mixed something at Arden. I remember cutting...
I'm sorry.
Oh, you got my computer.
I remember that when we did the mixing of the EP, that on Killing Floor, I believe I was sitting in Arden doing a little overdub of guitar on Killing Floor.
So we have
a little bitty in the background. Okay. You have to be listening carefully.
So we have Easley McCain Recording, and we have Arden Recording on it.
And also there was late
90s, early 90s.
Was it 86? It came out in 86, Swamp Surfing.
Oh, yeah, right. Y'all had a song on the early collection, Tab Falco's Frenzy label. So it's kind of that landscape that they were in, independent records, aura or umbrella of Alex and Tav, reaching out from the very local indie scene to Paris, France. Yeah. Here you go, Greg. That's my context.
And that, that was most of the bands that were doing independent kind of DIY rock and roll stuff. There was probably more of an audience in Europe, it seems like, at that time, for a lot of bands would get over and get on a label like New Rose or Crypt or something, and find that there was like an audience that was really into rock and roll overseas that maybe you didn't have here.
Yeah, and that On Go-Go thing was Australia.
Australia, exactly.
That first thing, that Frenzy thing, was also on Go-Go, because I think Tab had been touring in Australia. You would know what was going on because you were there.
Yeah.
I played with her before the Hellcats, but I didn't go on the overseas things, and you went, was that Australia thing have to do with the Algonquin?
Yeah, we went over there twice. I went with Pampaburns to Australia. But I remember maybe the Agogo thing came out first, actually, before all that happened.
That must have been pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're on a label, you're traveling the world.
It was my first time on an airplane.
That's Australia. So... So that the Hellcats was kind of an outgrowth of Tad Falco and the Panther Burns. Is that, was that, would you say that's true to say or no?
That sounds like a tumor. I'm not sure.
It was a sister band.
Sister band, there you go.
We can get into that detail later. Okay.
Until it requires surgery. Yeah.
Wow. Use the water hose.
So, did you want me to give the context for...
Yes. You were going to say why you chose this record.
Yeah, the reason that I chose the record is I've always been a fan. I make no bones about it. I'm a super fan. And because you guys are an amazing band doing cool covers of, like, you know, garage and rockabilly and 60s type stuff, but also like Hill Country Blues, like so many elements of American culture and roots music all coming together. You chose excellent covers, and then, you know, also were writing amazing original material. So I just want to say, you know, I was already a fan, so this record was already securely in my record collection along with Cherry Mansions. But during the pandemic, I'm a DJ, and so a lot of what I play, whether it's DJing out or on the radio station, we're both DJs at WYXR, a lot of what I spin is 45s, because whether it's a hit or a non-hit or an attempted hit, I'm playing mostly 50, 60 stuff, so it's a better music delivery system to carry around a box of 50 45s than two crates of 50 LPs. So during the pandemic, I found myself stuck at home during the pandemic doing a lot of tasks, and, you know, whether it was cutting the yard or doing stuff around the house, I had a lot more time to sit and listen deeply to LPs. And I also pruned a lot of my collection at that time. It was the perfect time to really sit and listen to every record that I had and decide what I really needed to keep and what I could probably jettison. And I started listening to the LP Hoodoo Train, and I realized I just kept coming back to it. Like, it made me appreciate the album all over again in a very new way, for how talented you are, what an amazing record and time capsule it was of Memphis music at that time, and like how mature. Like, it also gave me a context between listening to Cherry Mansions and then listening to this album, which feels like a fully realized band.
Should we introduce each of us individually?
Absolutely. So let me, would you like to do that? You guys, you could pass the mic around and everybody can tell their names and what they play.
Okay.
I'm going to hand it off to you. I'm Lisa McGochran.
Well, they want you to stand so they
can stand up.
They
can't see you. Those means.
I'm Lisa McGochran. I was at one of the three lead vocalists, and I play guitar and sometimes bass, and it just depended. And occasionally another instrument or two.
Misty.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Misty.
Hi, Misty.
No microphone.
Whatever. It's me, Misty. That's right. Yeah. I started out playing tambourine. I thought, this is the instrument for me. Some people say it's not really an instrument. I'm like, what the? It's there. You miss it if it's not there. But I became a drummer thanks to, I want to give a shout out to Herr Scherner. He let me sit down at his drums. And he took away everything but the floor tom and the snare. And I was a natural, thank God. Misty White, okay.
Thank you.
Ask me questions later.
Sue.
Hello. My name is Sue Hartline. I was Sue Ondine on the album. And actually, so if you look at your LP that you've treasured all these years, and finally look at the back, you'll notice that Missy and I, our pictures were interchanged.
And my name was misspelled on one thing, which made it be misspelled in Rolling Stone magazine.
Yeah, once a mistake gets started, it rolls down the hill.
The attention to detail or something, the translation between Memphis and France, I guess. So it's all
they're switched their places on.
I never knew until JB told me.
You thought that was you.
So I played the keyboards with the Hellcats, brought along very much by our very own Misty White, introducing to Ben. It was great.
Yes, it was more than great. Yay, Dad!
My name is Lori Godwin, really. Okay.
What?
But the stage name is Lorette Velvet. Yeah, I always wanted a nickname, so I really got a good one. I was a singer. I played guitar and also switched off to bass a lot of times when Lisa was playing guitar. So, yeah. And here's Diane.
Definitely went with no bass.
Yeah.
And hello, I'm Diane Green.
Yeah.
Also known as Diane Green. I was invited by Ms. Lori Godwin to join a band, all-girl band, after she saw the Odd Jobs play at the Antenna Club. She came
odd
up
job.
To me and said, "Are you interested in being in an all-girl band?" Yeah, I think it's about time. So I played guitar toward the end, but I started out on keyboard and songwriter, singer. So there you have it.
Thank you.
A shuddering cold come down my back. Rain is falling all down the tracks. My soul's been strung to the earth and black. Which way to Memphis? I can never go back. All glory is gold on this cloudy day. For my sins I would gladly pray. But each drop of rain is
And if you're enjoying yourself, if you're having a good time, this is a great time to think about WYXR, about the partnership with WYXR and Memphis Listening Lab. We appreciate both of these institutions. So fantastic. And we're in the middle of our pledge drive right now, so WYXR.org. If you're feeling inclined, now is the time to give, and we would really appreciate that. Lots of great diverse programming on the station, and it's all done right here in Memphis and curated just for you. So if you're feeling it, and right now we've got a sponsor that's doubling, I think.
Dragonfly.
Yeah, exactly. So now is a really great time to get.
It's where Sue works.
Yeah, where Sue Undine works. And they've been so generous, and they are matching donations right now. So
we'll tell you all about it if you come down the hall afterwards.
That's right.
Oh, they're in the building.
That's another great thing about WYXR, Memphis Listening Lab, all part of a great community right here in the Crosstown Concourse. So many partnerships, everybody working together to make this community, and we really appreciate you all being a part of that too. So thanks for coming out tonight. We really appreciate you. Let's talk a little bit about what we heard there.
Oh, I want to. Here, I got a question.
Yeah, go.
I have a question for the band. So it seems like a dramatic leap from Cherry Mansions to the record we heard. It sounds, I love Cherry Mansions, but this has like a really more refined sound. What happened in the interim, and you know what, talk about how this record was made, please. And it's a little Bob Eubanks is here. They can't come up front?
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to come up, that's totally true. Yeah, would you like to come up so everyone can see if you want to talk?
Well,
and you're welcome to just go seat as well.
No,
you're in the main
here,
three.
Sit here, Misty.
Yeah, Misty, have a seat.
Yeah.
Robert, your question. It's just time passed and we got better.
Just playing and rehearsing and doing gigs?
Yeah.
Well, talk about that. Like, where'd you gig and where'd you rehearse and how did you? I mean, you could just, was it just playing?
We did a lot of rehearsing over at Tab Falco's house on Princeton Avenue in Binghamton, and. We had our, you know, equipment set up there, along with his motorcycles that were in the living room. And we practiced once or twice a week, maybe. Lisa, do you remember? Yeah?
Tell me.
It was a lot.
This one's not very long, sorry.
We also went on tour for a lot. And we just got used to playing the same songs over and over. However, by the time we were making this record, new things were... dashed in like Don't Fight It. I did not expect to be singing that song except for maybe a couple of days.
How did that song come into the repertoire?
That's a good question. I do not know.
So I think she knows.
Did you know? But I know Steve Crawford and Wilson Pickett worked on it together. So that's fabulous.
I had to do that because you were the outgoing person that could say that. It's because Don't Fight It was, I thought it was on like Birds with Graham Parsons,
Misty,
and also Wilson Pickett wrote it or something.
Laurie, yes, get over this.
Anyway, I knew that.
Laurie,
I just felt like that. Anyway, I gave that to her to do because I couldn't sing that without looking ridiculous. But I'm not like a dancer. And some years later, I saw Alex do that with the Box Tops in the reunion. Yeah, in Epcot, that song.
Were you saying that Alex had suggested the song?
Not that one. He suggested I did my part, the Zorma Thomas, because that's in New Orleans.
Right, okay.
Thing.
No, that was great.
But she's the one that, I knew I couldn't sing that. So, and you were like, well, why don't you sing it? It's like, if I like said, can you do this with your voice? I'm like, I'm gonna, you don't... She didn't need my advice. But anyway, she was the one to do that because it's an outgoing person's song.
Well, so there's also, so you were saying like you were on tour, and that's the best way to tighten up a set. That's how you really learn how to be a musician, right? But also, like when you got in the studio with Davis and Doug, I'm imagining, because as I spoke to you earlier, and there was a lot of prodding on their part, like hey, making suggestions, making critiques, or not critiques, but like definitely helping you build some of these original songs, right?
Absolutely. Oh, and knowing and including, man, the equipment in a sound studio like that back then is nothing like, I mean, I'm recording now to make another record, future upcoming, but I'm working with somebody that has been with Universal Recording for once, but he's semi-retired now, but, you know, he could use that board, that sound board with all those thousands of knobs, and I couldn't figure that out, you know, but my life depended on it. So Easily Studio, they were geniuses at being able to work through all
Well,
that.
It wasn't digital, of course, and it was recorded on, correct me, reel-to-reel
right.
Tape.
Yeah, probably 16-inch, or 16-track.
Doug and Davis had a lot of, you know, they set us up in different ways in the studio to achieve a lot of the sounds with different amps they had, different possibly some pedals and stuff like that, that I don't remember having a pedal myself. I just had a gain knob on my amp. So, I mean, that was kind of something they did. They paid a lot of attention to how we were set up. And then Doug was all the time trying to figure out how to make it better or what to add. He would record it, then he'd put it off on a cassette tape, and he'd run out to his car and listen to it in the car. And then he would come back in with some more ideas, you know, about how to, some vocals we might want to, background vocals or little keyboard parts or
That's
stuff
right.
like that.
Because, like, that Leslie that was on that last song was his idea, that Leslie...
On Antarctica.
On yeah. Antarctica, which is to do with something that got a political
there.
Situation
it
that was better the next year with the Madrid Protocol, so it's kind of an obsolete thing. But he did this Leslie thing for the that was you could hear on the organ, and he made a suggestion on a keyboard part for that that made it have sort of a hook to it that, you know, that thing was Doug. And then what was the other thing I was to say about Doug? Oh, yeah, remember? On Cherry Mansions when the tornado siren went off, so he recorded it.
Right, on Cherry Mansions on Wall of Death, we were recording during the tornado, and the sirens were going off, so at the end of the song, during the song, he ran out and put a mic out there, so there's a, you know, tornado siren on that one.
And that's called Wall of Death, it's on our first album.
Hopping.
Called Wall of Death. It's on my first album, Cherry Mansions. Available on eBay.
So true.
So, yes. You were saying earlier that also, like, Doug made lots of suggestions for you when you were playing keyboards. Like, hey, maybe try this.
No, so the keyboards was great, and it's a lot of fun, because, like, Lisa mentioned he had the Leslie and the World. I mean, he had a bunch of different keyboard options, and so I just like playing live. I had a very basic, you know, keyboard part, which I played on the recording. But then, like, being able to lay over something,
exactly.
So that's great.
And
that was all. That was all Doug.
And you like, played that part that was with the Leslie, right?
I don't remember.
I thought
you wrote that, Lisa.
I know, but I think you.
I think you wrote it.
No, I wrote it.
but
he did that one part. But I think
Treat
you had
bad.
You. Do that Leslie part.
Oh, okay.
The,
yeah,
with
yeah,
the organ
yeah.
through a Leslie
yeah.
was giving it this sound.
Yeah, it was fun.
He brought in Gracious.
Right here, right now.
He brought Gracious Steele in on congos.
Gracious Steele.
And he got
congos.
Jim's fake on the sax on the first EP on I Don't Need That One. That was Jim Spake mm-hmm. on the sax because of Doug thinking of that.
Yeah.
So he had a lot to do with stuff.
Great production ideas. I mean, that's cool. Like, I mean, because I think when I think about you guys touring with Tav and all that kind of stuff. Like, Tav definitely had an aesthetic and an image. He was very image conscious. But now Doug had the real, Doug had real production ideas to offer. He could really help you grow as a band.
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely.
He helped in the studio, and then we, when we got up and played live, we were sort of recreating our practices. It was two different things. But I really liked the studio stuff.
How much time do we have left?
Oh, well, thanks for coming out.
Before we listen to
the side two. Greg, I was going to close.
5 minutes.
When you asked about the New Rose and how all that got started, I particularly remember Patrick McTay coming to Memphis to meet Tav, and we picked him up at the airport, and here's this really, really towering Parisian man in cowboy boots and a cowboy hat. And
he was ready.
He was here. And
big cigar.
And a big cigar. Big cigar, always smoking a cigar. And I remember he was in, you know, in our practice room, I think, that night. And I had just learned how to play Special Rider because I had been listening to the Insect Trust, which was one of Tav's record collection is where I started learning a lot of different things, and I played it for him. And he seemed like he was interested.
And we made demos with Doug.
Individually.
Like, I did Funnel. And there was a basket
that I did Funnel of Love because you and I had always done that with Tav before we even started the whole. But And Doug did a basketball for the drums for the
and there was a typewriter bell for the ding on the demo. I just got a copy of that. And I don't know which ones you might have done Special Writer for the
and
demo.
And that's something, yeah, we gave to
and there was one with
the Rose.
There was probably three demos probably. I know I did one, you probably did Special Writer or something, and we still had a copy of that demo. And then Diane must have done one. And then whatever he must have seen. That was in the 8. Well, I don't get a copy. I didn't get a copy of the.
Where are those promos?
The demos. But that would have been probably 80s.
So that's what got him interested with this, and that's how we ended up on the label. Yeah.
You walked away and left me out in the cold after I was so good. Shed a tear. I did my part when you were here. When you were here. When you were here. When you were here.
young man all hell-bent on getting out. Moving faster all the time, you couldn't understand what love was about.
Hey everybody, it's me, Misty. Excuse me, Greg, it's on trip. Or trip, all you want, but not on that chord. Anyway, that song, My Love is Dying, beautiful song. But it really was a true story. So anyway, on that, Lorette wrote it. Big round of applause, Lorette wrote the song. Lorette called that, wrote the song, sings the song. And if you listen to it again, when you get it on eBay, you'll hear it in her voice. You know. So, but with that song, I was told, do not use sticks on the drums. I'm like, oh, okay. So I just stroked it with my hands. So now, when you go get that album on Discogs or eBay, it's called Hoodoo Train. You can listen to my fingers on the drum.
Massage the beat.
I was playing the stand-up bass for the first time on that.
You did?
And try to keep a beat that way. Come on.
Doug Easley had me play a stand-up bass for the first time on that too, but that's the only reason I got to do that. That was cool.
That difficult?
No. Well, I mean, he made
sure it wasn't.
He made sure it wasn't.
He just didn't keep me from being afraid of it and said, "No, you just do this," and it wasn't. Oh yeah, I can do this. And it was just for that one. Every time we played it live, I used an electric bass.
Okay. Well, that is one thing I think that's. I mean, you guys all are maturing as songwriters on this album. You're picking great covers and stuff, but the songwriting is really next level, I think. Like, and there's like that's a beautiful kind of jazz type of song, and then you're writing kind of like these political pop songs too. I mean, it really is. It's kind of amazing. And then there's all through that, there's still the echo of some of your earlier influences, like the Hill Country Blues stuff, and I mean, there's just like something for everybody on this record. And like you saying that, like Doug made it easy. Like, they really are amazing.
Particular song. He didn't like have to teach me what to do on every song, but that one, I wouldn't have been even touching a stand-up bass if he hadn't, you know, that.
Right, you would have never even thought to do that, right?
So sometimes he would, you know, come in and that would be his arrangement, I guess, in a way of that, but not on every song.
Right. Yeah. Just where he thought maybe you needed a little extra direction or something. And I think he is like, so a lot of things that Doug recorded, he's mainly known as like an engineer, but he's that kind of engineer who is also a de facto producer.
Yeah.
Like, he knows exactly where to point you. That's what makes him such an artist at what he does, I think.
He was the producer, yeah.
Yeah, totally, absolutely.
Craig, you're making it, and everybody, it's sounding like this was like really, you know, Girl Scouts at the campfire kind of, everybody getting along.
is that the case?
I was thrown out of the Girl Scouts, very dumb.
We signed an NDA years ago.
What's the question?
Did y'all fight?
Did y'all get along?
Yeah, we fought.
The hardest thing about being in a band is being in a band. That's just the hard, you know, being in a band is, well, any relationship, it's like a human relationship. And like, especially in our age group, we were like in our 20s and we were young. And I was from a punk era for sure. And I was older than everybody else, and less mature than any of them. Go figure. But we'd have disagreements, but I kind of just let things slide very often, because Lorette was pretty much in charge, and I was fine with that, because I don't want to be anybody's boss. That's a given, and
I
was just having too much fun.
Charge.
What?
I don't think I was in charge.
You were in receipts?
No, I think we really did try to be pretty diplomatic on what songs, you know, because we were all three singers, so we wanted to give time to each person. And so, I mean, I think we did a real good job at that, and our friendship has lasted this long, so.
The times where you have a disagreement is so it's such little time.
You know, you'll have a disagreement. It's such of a tiny, minute percentage of it. Like, you'll remember it because there was a disagreement. And it was like 30 seconds, and then you're like playing 90% of it. We're not like, I'm fighting while I'm playing. I mean, you're not doing it. They were friends. You know? So,
I enjoyed every song I was playing. I was glad to play on your songs. I had fun. I remember every single song that I played on, every single part I played in your song. Here you go.
It was, I mean, we all just had a lot of fun. I mean, it was. So there was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of going back and forth. I mean, it was, but it was always conversations, never like yelling or getting, you know, never got ugly. It was just a lot of like conversation and disagreeing about things, and maybe took a long time to get through it, but everybody just had a lot of fun hanging out together. So,
well, I don't remember disagreement in coming up with our songs, you know, like thinking
I feel
about
like there's a lot of pressure on us to really try to be good at what we were doing. And when we started out, you know, I remember we asked Brenda Brewer to play drums. I said, Brenda, can you play drums? She said, no, but I can learn. And she came back a week later and was playing drums.
She was there at the beginning.
In the very beginning. So, I mean, there was like a, felt a lot of pressure to really, you know our instruments and learn and try to be really the best we could at what we're doing at our level, you know.
Like when we're sitting in a practice, I don't remember arguing about how to play a song, you know. I remember you said this is what you want, and in fact, if I brought something and I wasn't sure about it, I'd ask you, and if you didn't like that, you know, like I said, what about this Joe South song? Would that, so like if you didn't like it, I didn't play it.
We definitely were opinionated, but thank God for amnesia.
I'm not saying that we never disagreed, I'm talking about playing a, figuring out a song.
Yeah.
Well, just figuring out the chords was the main puzzle, like, you know, back then.
I don't remember arguing about figuring out a song is my point. And
right.
Then, and that's what we were doing a lot of the time in practice. And then, what was I saying a second ago? I didn't finish that, but whatever.
Well, we couldn't download songs in already from Genius or whatever it is, guitar, Ultimate Guitar,
yeah.
And print it out, you know, it's like not... Nothing like today, and we would just be hearing stuff and trying to figure out what chord it was, which, depending on, you know, how much music background one would have figure that out.
Was there any collaboration as, when you're writing your own songs, how much of it is like fully like you're writing it all by yourself in a vacuum, and how much of it is like collaborated?
There was a lot of mixture of that.
There was a mixture of that.
Backdoor
Slam, I think I just wrote it.
I came in your loft and
Yeah,
I came in to your house and you know you're living over on Front Street, right?
On Front Street.
I'm sorry, not Front, but over in Binghamton.
You
came in and you had some words and I had my guitar and I started playing.
Yes, yep.
And so that one just came straight off the cuff. And but you know we also did our solo stuff at home and came up with songs and chords and brought it in. So it was just a mishmash of everything. Really.
And then there was like Hoodoo Train, like I got to play a call and response thing,
yeah.
Which is fun for me. I mean, you could have, I guess, played every single thing on it, but it was because you wrote it. But it was fun to get to do like ding, 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 and I would do something back.
Yeah, I liked it. And that song actually came out of me listening to Howling Wolf do the do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, I need something like that.
We mentioned Brenda. We also had Linda Heck at the beginning.
Linda Heck.
And
mm-hmm.
it was like Linda Heck, Brenda Brewer, Diane Green, me and Lori. And then Giovanna Pizzorno played for quite a while. And Bob Fordyce helped, of the Odd Jobs, helped before Giovanna. And then
well, Benny Carter was on drums.
That's what I was going to say. When Giovanna couldn't get back from Italy at the end of 86.
Oh, yeah, she was.
Was 80? Yeah. I'm getting confused. 87. At the end of 87, then we did that's when Benny and also Richard Roseborough was on a track, Killing Hard Time Killing Floor, and Misty was doing the percussion, and it wasn't just tambourine and block and spiel and a lot of stuff, and then she was like preparing to be the drummer because Giovanna was gone. She was great, but she ended up playing with Tab later on. So I wanted to mention those people because they put in time, and Elizabeth Pritchard had a few gigs on guitar, so I remember
Nancy
that.
Apple.
Anyway, that song called Shine started out originally with the Odd Jobs. It was known as Song in C. I wrote that completely, the words, but we had to refigure out how we were going to play it. But that was the origination of that song. And
is that song about somebody in particular?
It isn't. Well, it's fiction, but it is after talking with a fellow that was a fellow student at the Art Academy, which changed and now doesn't exist anymore, but he was discussing someone that he knew in Iowa, and it touched me hearing about this person, and figured I needed to write a song about her, and and it started out with the Odd Jobs. They backed me up, and I just made it up as with a chord C. Started in C.
Talk some about how the cover photo came to be. Is there a story in
the armory? Where?
It's in a train car.
vintage train car.
Yep, a little train car. Who took the picture? Was it Trey?
Trey Harrison.
Also original member of the Odd Jobs.
Yeah. I think he took the Cherry Mansions pictures too.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. The back is Christy and Jimbo, who owned
James
Massenburg.
Oh, in the back, yeah.
Well, yes. There was another photographer on the back, which would have been the guy in Little Rock that Misty put together.
Bruce Coburn.
And Misty.
His name is Jerry, that we can't talk about him.
Can we talk about that? Because Misty had a great story about the train picture on the front, like where it came from.
It's Memphis Defense Depot. They had these old cars out there, cars that Tab knew about. Tab, he's our mentor. He always knew where to do things and how to make it happen. And he liked the elegance of that shot, and he allowed Christy and Jimbo to be in it. And that was really great.
Well, we wanted them there. They were very important friends of our family.
Yeah, the Tab liked the idea to have more in the shot.
Well, I have something to say.
Was there something else I need to say about that?
Jimbo
had Decadence Manor on Madison Avenue, and we often... Very often went in there before shows, and he let us wear his clothes.
There's a flashback. Right.
Just like Gypsies and...
And Buddy, too. And so Jimbo and Buddy, and then we would borrow their gowns and different clothes and bring them back after we played.
Awesome
play. Sometimes. So I think we really wanted
the shirt I was wearing on that cover was from Jimbo's shop.
What happened to him? What happened to Jimbo?
He went to New York.
He's in New York. He's a film industry.
Yeah.
He's a set designer in New York
City. Awesome.
Questions from the audience?
Robert. Oh, so we're about
cut
to
it off. Sorry.
We're about to wrap it up here. But I want to say, I want to make sure everybody knows. I'm sorry? Yes.
I got a quick question.
Yes.
I don't know if everybody said where they came from in the band, all the long distance they came to be here tonight, and it's so wonderful to have y'all together. Thank you so much. Is it influenced by your connection with the Panther Burns?
What was the question?
The band?
Yeah.
What was that now?
The name of the band. Is it influenced by your connection with the
Panther
Burns?
Yes.
Well, we used to get... videos and watch them of like B movies from like Hollywood B movies in the 50s and 60s. And one of those movies we watched over at Tab's house on a little tiny little TV was called She Devils on Wheels.
Yeah.
And the opening song was called We Are the Hellcats Nobody Likes.
Get off the run.
Man Eaters on Motorbikes. That's perfect.
That's on Swamp Surfing in Memphis from our first.
Not only it was She Devils on Wheels, there was all, you know, raise your hand if you've seen the movie. For those who don't, it's just basically these young girls, and they got their motorbikes. There's this one little girl. She's young. She's got like a scooter. Yeah. You know, a car. This was set way back, you know, 50s, 60s. And so she had to join, and they put her through this terrible, terrible, you know, whatever.
Initiation.
And so, anyway, that was our theme song. But the Hellcat thing, you know, who knew? I'm swimming at the Dave in on Union one time here in Memphis, and joined my free pool, you know. And this man, he says, "Is your daddy a lumberman?" And I'm like, "Well, I know I'm kind of stocky, good build. But why the hell would you think I'm a lumberman's daughter?" And he goes, "Because you got the hoo-hoo cat on your back."
And it's
the Hellcat.
Where is it?
Don't
worry. You mean
about
a
tax? It's not a monkey. That's the Hoo Cat.
All right.
Yeah, I'm like, okay. So I said, well, where is it? It's in Gurdon, Arkansas, is the order of the Hoo Hoo. They only meet on the ninth month of the ninth day of the 999 minute, ninth year. This man told me all about it. I'll never forget. It's been years now, right? Now he's like a monkey on my back. You know, like a pickup stick monkey, but
it's like a cat.
Your daddy lumberman? I'm like, no, but
well, all right. And with that, adieu.
Okay.
So thanks, y'all. Thanks everybody for coming, and thanks to all the Hellcats.